Welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion.
Let's go to the lighting of the candle.
All right. And our quote is from Dorothea Dix. With care and patience, people may accomplish things which, to an indolent person, would appear impossible. I do have a reading. I don't actually recommend this book, which is supposedly a biography of Dorothea Dix, but it was written in 1975, and it's quite a bit fictionalized by giving her thoughts and conversations which we have no way of knowing ever took place. And I noticed that in the brief part that mentions Reconstruction, it goes by rather quickly, but has the view that I was taught back in the 1960s about how it was such a shame that these uneducated people got taken advantage of by Northern carpetbaggers and so on. But it does have some actual excerpts from her writings and diary, which is what I am using it for. And I'm going to be giving an example of the sort of thing that she saw. She recounted as she went around looking at what served as mental institutions at the time, which were often prisons, almshouses, and various types of homes, just recording what she saw. Newburyport Almshouse, 80 inmates, several of the partially insane apparently very comfortable, two very improperly situated, an insane man not considered incurable in an outbuilding whose rooms opened on what was called the dead room, affording, in lieu of companionship with the living, a contemplation of corpses. The other subject was a woman in a cellar. I desired to see her. Much reluctance was shown. She was supposed to be dangerous and often naked. I persisted. As we descended the stairs, a strange, unnatural noise seemed to proceed from beneath our feet. A door to a closet beneath the staircase was opened, revealing in the imperfect light a female apparently wasted to a skeleton, partially wrapped in blankets, face furrowed by suffering. In that contracted space, unlighted, unventilated, she poured forth the wailings of despair. How long, how many days or years was she imprisoned there? For years. In another place, after some difficulties, I was conducted into the yard, where was a small building of rough boards imperfectly joined. This shanty, enclosing a cage, might have been 8 or 10 feet square. A narrow passage within allowed to pass in front of the cage. Very cold, air within burdened with most noisome vapors. All still, save now and then a low groan. At last I saw a human being, partially extended, cast upon his back amidst a mass of filth. He'll soon rouse up and be noisy enough, said the mistress. He'll scream and beat about the place like a wild beast. And cannot you make him more comfortable? Can he not have some clean, dry place and a fire? As for clean, it will do no good. He's cleaned out now and then, but what's the use for such a creature? But a fire, there is space even here for a small box stove. If he had a fire, he'd only pull off his clothes. It's no use. I made no impression. How do you give him his food? I see no means of introducing anything here. Oh, she pointed to the floor. One of the bars is cut shorter there. We push it through there. There, impossible. You would not treat your lowest dumb animal with that disregard to decency. As for what he eats or where he eats, it makes no difference to him. He's as soon swallow one thing as another. So this is an example of the sort of impressions that she gained. It's not an exaggeration to say that Dorothea Dix single-handedly revolutionized care for the mentally ill, not only all over the United States, as you'll hear, but around the world. This one woman, who herself suffered from serious physical illness much of her life, also worked for prison reform and supervised the entire nursing operation of the American Civil War. None of this could have been predicted from her beginnings. Dorothea was born in 1802 in a small town in Maine. She was the eldest of three. Her mother was often in poor health, and her father was an itinerant hellfire preaching minister. Long afterwards, Dorothea said, "I never knew childhood." With her father absent or controlling and critical, and her mother ill, Dorothea fetched water, scrubbed clothes, cooked meals, cleaned the small house, and cared for her younger siblings. There was no question of going to school. Her father sold religious tracts, which he made, that is, Dorothea was assigned to cut and sew together this thick, rough paper. It was very difficult to manage. But from these pamphlets, she learned to read. The writings reflected her father's fixation on the wrath of God. She wondered sometimes why he never spoke or wrote about God's love. The only bright spots in her life came when the family visited her grandparents in Boston. They were well off and treated her with kindness. They opened a larger world to her curious mind. Finally, at age 12, Dorothea ran away to her grandmother's home. Her grandfather had since died. It was a better life, but grandmother expected Dorothea to spend her days embroidering samplers and learning feminine virtues. When the girl rebelled, her grandmother decided she would be better off with her sister, Great Aunt Sarah Duncan, in Worcester. Great Aunt Sarah supported Dorothea's wish for an education. She paid for tutors and encouraged Dolly, her nickname, to read from her grandfather's library. The teenager hadn't forgotten her younger brothers at home and wanted to earn money so that they could have schooling. So at the age of 14, she became the teacher in a one-room school. This was an era where all schooling was private with fees. As almost a child herself, Dorothea was very strict in discipline and followed the educational precepts of the time, but it seems she was respected and even loved by her pupils. It was at this moment that Dorothea first heard William Ellery Channing, the Boston Unitarian minister, speak. He wasn't impressive to look at, but his delivery was magnetic, and he spoke of the goodness of the divine and the dignity of humanity. He also took seriously Christ's admonitions to help the poor. Dorothea convinced her grandmother to let her have a room in a barn to conduct free classes for poor children, in addition to her regular teaching. She also wrote stories and explanatory essays for children about the natural world, machinery, and other concepts that were published and sold well, and she was still only in her teens. Her cousin Edward warned her she needed rest, but of course she would give up this teaching business when she became his wife. Her duty then would be to look pretty, run the household, and entertain his clients. They had been close since she had moved to Massachusetts, and she genuinely liked him, but this was not the life she wanted. She wrote him a letter explaining that she couldn't be the wife he wanted. She would not have anyone telling her what she could or couldn't do. She knew that she was destined to somehow make herself useful in the greater world. Edward didn't reply, but soon after, Dorothea learned he was engaged to someone else. Not only did Dorothea eschew marriage, but balls, parties, and other society functions, and her health continued to decline. She seemed to have lung issues, but it's possible she also suffered from depression. It was a great relief when William Ellery Channing invited her to accompany his family out of the city to their summer house in Rhode Island as a tutor for their children. She blossomed in the rural atmosphere and greatly enjoyed the intellectual stimulation of this educated family. Dr. Channing was also fighting ill health, and per his doctor's instructions, he decided to take his family to the island of St. Croix for the winter. They again wished Dorothea to accompany them. Dorothea's health did improve, as did her knowledge of fauna and flora unknown before. At first, she just wrote that the enslaved Negroes, as she called them, were interesting. But as she learned of some of the cruel treatments imposed on these people, who she had first seen as Mary, she spoke to Dr. Channing, who said, "Every human being has in him the gem of the greatest idea in the universe. And to unfold this is the end of his existence. Is it possible that such a being is meant to be owned as a tree or a brute? All, however poor or ignorant or despised, are possessed of sacred rights, inseparable from their human nature." So this was the belief that Dorothea also had. On her return, the now healthy young woman set up a new girls' school, which filled quickly based on her reputation. But as the sole teacher and administrator, and highly involved in Dr. Channing's church, she suffered a new breakdown and her doctor told her she must give up teaching. She slowly improved, and Dr. Channing encouraged her to travel to Europe. He gave her letters of recommendation to numerous contacts. Sadly, she had new health crises on the ship and barely made it to a hotel. Luckily, friends of the Channings, the Rathbone family, took her in immediately and cared for her as if she were their kin. At their home, she participated in discussions about social issues in Britain and America, but she felt herself woefully uninformed about conditions in her own country. Her grandmother, who was 91, became ill and died before Dorothea could return, and the family home was sold. Her brothers were now independent, and Dorothea inherited enough money that she didn't need to work to survive. So she traveled almost constantly, spending winters in the South. In 1840, at the age of 38, Dorothea was asked to teach female inmates in a Cambridge, Massachusetts jail. She was a success, but one day she heard screaming from outside the area of her classroom, and she asked why all the women in the prison weren't in her class. She was told, "It's one of the mad uns. They were kept apart because they were dangerous." Dorothea insisted on seeing them and found a half dozen women huddled together in a cold, damp, and filthy unfurnished room. They had committed no crimes, but the only insane asylums were for those who could pay, so many places would keep them in prisons. Dorothea took on this cause, bringing in blankets, warm clothes, and food over the objections of the warden, who said the mad women would just destroy them. She even requested stoves to heat the rooms. When the warden laughed at this, Dorothea appealed to the courts and had her observations picked up by the newspapers. Eventually, the stoves appeared, but Dorothea realized the problem was much bigger. She appealed for help to her mentor, Channing, but his own health was still declining. He recommends she contact Samuel Gridley Howe. Now, he ran an institute for the deaf and blind, where a young woman named Laura Bridgman was taught. She was the precursor to Helen Keller, and that's where Ann Sullivan learned her techniques. Another resource was Horace Mann, who, in addition to his interest in public education, had already made a survey of prisons and almshouses in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. They all agreed that someone should investigate and publicize the unconscionable treatment of those whom medical science was just beginning to consider ill rather than evil or possessed. Certainly, in earlier eras, there was a connotation that these people were somehow cursed by the devil or bewitched or dangerous to everyone or deliberately bad. Dorothea visited the McLean Hospital in Charlestown, where Dr. Van Bell, who had toured institutions in Europe, housed his mentally ill patients in comfortable rooms without restraints. He offered a variety of activities and treated the patients kindly. So it was possible, but this was a private institution with inmates whose families had the means to support them. In 1841, Dorothea, a lone woman, took on a survey of institutions throughout Massachusetts. She traveled through the winter in unheated trains and carriages. Caretakers often thought their charges could not feel cold, heat, damp, or even pain. In small towns, the inmates were housed in private homes, where they were kept in cellars, sheds, or even on roofs year-round. She found people, quote, confined in cages, closets, cellars, stalls, pens, chained, naked, beaten with rods, and lashed into obedience. All types of mental disturbances were housed together, or housed with criminals who could further mistreat them. After visiting every institution in the Commonwealth, Dorothea wrote what she called a memorial to the legislature, listing the various conditions she had personally documented. She didn't blame individuals, wardens, feeling the problem was ignorance and neglect rather than personal cruelty. This memorial had a bombshell effect and has been called the first piece of social research ever conducted in America. The jailkeepers and almshouse masters protested, despite Dix's insistence that the problem was the overall system. But she also had many important supporters. A legislative committee took up her proposal to establish humane hospitals paid for by the Commonwealth, and eventually it passed. Dorothea moved on, first to Rhode Island, where Nicholas Brown, founder of the university with his name, left $30,000 for the erection of a mental hospital. Dix began to accost other wealthy men with requests for donations. She wrote, "I encounter nothing which a determined will, created by the necessities of the cause I advocate, does not enable me to vanquish." In 1843, Dorothea spent 10 weeks crisscrossing New York State, traveling through mud, rain, and snow. In her memorial to the legislature of that state, she commended them for several well-run institutions. Also, New York State actually had laws prohibiting putting the mentally ill in jails. But the private almshouses were a different story. Dix insisted on the importance of regular inspections by the state. Before discussion of her proposals began, she was already off to New Jersey and Pennsylvania. She was becoming known and was welcomed by reformers, not always by the leaders of the institutions she had come to inspect, but she never backed down, even when warned the inmates could be dangerous. Here are excerpts from her letters of the time. August, Lancaster from Philadelphia, overseer of the poor in bad health and temper, changed mood when he learned my name. Went to poorhouse, stayed 4 hours. He asked me to write for their paper. I objected, no one would know me. "You are mistaken," he said. "Every man and woman in Lancaster, if not our state, knows who you are." Had to write. Stage to Gettysburg, saw jail. Stage for Bedford, 13.5 hours hard riding. Poor horse. Set off a little past midnight to cross mountains. Reached top of Alleghenies at daylight. Wagon to Somerset. Stage 3 hours to Mount Pleasant. Had to leave at once because it went only once a week. Dreadful night's journey. Waynesboro, stage for Wheeling, 6 a.m. to Carsville, Ohio. Saw almshouse and jail, horrible, wrote 4 pages. Stage, Columbus, midnight. Prison hospital for insane, very welcome. Next day, almshouse and asylum for blind, wrote 12 pages for the court. Wheeling, 34 hours without stop except to change horses. Saw jail, wrote for paper, tired. Took boat on the Ohio, 60 miles, boat to Pittsburgh. Arrived 10 p.m., prisons, jails, almshouse. To Warren, no road. Would take more than 50 miles horseback. Cannot attempt that. Had to take long route through New York by Jamestown. How to get to Franklin? A skiff for 69 miles down the Allegheny, or a wagon over a road for which I have no terms sufficiently graphic? Wagon rejected, I proceeded to the banks, where I discovered an old waterman astride upon a drift log, half underwater, chewing a cud and whittling away on a pine stick. Took myself at 2 the following morning to this precious vehicle, and after 19 hours steady travel, found myself with the U.S. mails in Franklin, 39 miles from Warren. Such roads by which I reached the interior country, 4 carriages broke down. Why the horses did not is a wonder. The last carriage I hired had seen hard service. I suggested to my driver to proceed with more care over the rocks, but he graciously responded he knowed how to drive a horse. His eloquence was abridged by the creaking of the springs. Down one came crushed and broken. A dilemma. There seemed to be no alternative for me but to walk to Ebersburg 5 long miles or spend the night in the forest. So this is just an example. As for those of us who have complained about road trips or airplane delays, these things at all times of day and night, traveling and very uncomfortable. Now this time when she was in the forest, she was very lucky. A local man came by leading an extra horse. So he took Dorothea to a nearby house where she could borrow a saddle and ride into town. In each state she toured, she wrote up memoranda, or as she called them, memorials, which she presented to the legislature, along with requests for state financing and oversight of asylums. Overlapping with her main crusade, she advocated better conditions in prisons overall and separate detention facilities for juveniles. Early in 1845, Dix wrote, "I have traveled over 10,000 miles in the last 3 years. I have visited 18 penitentiaries, 100 county jails, more than 5,000 almshouses and other institutions, besides hospitals and houses of reform." But this was only the beginning. She went on to Kentucky, the Carolinas, Tennessee, Missouri, and Mississippi. And this is still the 1840s. The state of roads and travel was primitive. Along the way, she submitted her memorials, and a number of state legislatures passed bills to support the indigent insane. Later, she added Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Arkansas, and Michigan. She often brought supplies, such as blankets and books, for prison libraries. She personally met with financiers and businessmen and basically shamed them into making donations of land and money for new institutions. She wasn't done. She went to locations as far apart as Alabama and Nova Scotia. In Canada, she was present at a maritime rescue, which led her to propose specific improvements to the current life-saving equipment, which were adopted. So she was very good at analyzing systems, apparently. Her friends worried about her health, which had stopped her from teaching, but she remained robust under this grueling schedule. And I've seen that with some of the women that I have talked about, that when they had no useful employment, they would often succumb to illness, which might have been linked to depression. And when they felt they had a mission, they suddenly did much better. She did have some health setbacks, but she said she thought about the people she was visiting. If I am cold, they too are cold. If I am weary, they are distressed. If I am alone, they are abandoned. And she was traveling alone the entire time. She refused all accolades, awards, and tributes. She had no interest in having her portrait painted or her likeness sculpted, both of which were offered. She refused to have any of the new institutions named after her, and she refused to publish personal memoirs, using her writing only for the official communications to state legislatures. She stayed out of the debates on abolition and suffrage, feeling she needed to devote all her energies to her one cause, but it's clear from her emphasis on respect for everyone and from her own independent career where her sympathies lay. By the spring of 1848, Dorothea had traveled over 60,000 miles, observing over 9,000 individuals. She turned her attention to lobbying for the federal government to set aside over 12,000 acres for the benefit of the mentally ill, blind, and deaf. After many delays, it passed, but President Franklin Pierce vetoed it, claiming social welfare was the responsibility of the states. We would never hear that today, right? Disappointed, Dorothea decided to travel to Europe, but rather than vacation, she toured institutions throughout England, Scotland, the Channel Islands. Despite speaking only a little French, she visited France and went on to Italy, where she met with the Pope. She went to Greece and Constantinople, always traveling alone. She visited Russia, Austria, Norway, Denmark, Holland, Germany, and Belgium. She was then in her 50s, but insisted she had no problems, even when she was the only English-speaking person on a boat or train. Perhaps a more daunting journey was to Texas in 1859, and back north through Louisiana, all the way up to Minnesota and Wisconsin. Her newest suggestion was that, quote, feeble-minded children could be trained so that they could support themselves. When the Civil War began, the Secretary of War, Simon Cameron, appointed Dix as a superintendent of Army nurses, in spite of the fact that she had no nursing experience. At first, she required that nurses be over 35, plain-looking and plainly dressed, because heaven forbid you could have some young, beautiful woman there with all these soldiers. But with the depth of need that occurred, she couldn't be too picky. Those of you old enough may remember a scene from Gone with the Wind where wounded and dying soldiers overwhelmed the facilities in Washington, D.C. The area was still largely a swamp, which was the worst climate for recovery. And for descriptions of the daily routine in this setting, you could see Louisa May Alcott's memoir, Hospital Sketches. She was not over 35 at the time, so was able to go there. She ended up getting so ill herself that she had to go home. Dorothea Dix did recruit 3,000 women, but she considered her work a failure. Doctors refused to cede power and resented the nursing staff. And Dorothea was uncomfortable with the 600 Catholic nuns who had volunteered. She resigned in 1865. After the war, she helped raise funds for a national monument, and she also went back to her original crusade. Now there was more focus on the mentally ill, and because of direct effects of the war itself, the numbers of the needy had grown to outstrip previous allocations. If you think of all the people who had been either in the military or affected by the progress of the military through many states, there was a great need. Dorothea wrote, "It would seem that all of my work is to be done over as far as the insane are concerned. Language is poor to describe the miserable state of these poor wretches in dungeons and cells." But she also saw progress in a number of states. She continued to travel, including to the southern U.S., where many cities had been ravaged by war. Eventually, she went all the way to California, And again, we're talking right after the Civil War. The way to California was not easy. At one point, she was finally diagnosed with malaria as the cause of her intermittent illnesses throughout the years. In 1881, at the age of 79, she retired to a suite in the Trenton Mental Hospital, one of the first she had caused to be built. She died in 1887, and per her wishes, was buried in Cambridge, Massachusetts, under a simple headstone bearing only her name. Now, when I do these talks, I always try to tie these into something happening today, and sometimes it's sad to know that works. Just since I was working on this, May 12th, New York Times, talking about San Francisco wanting to clean up its streets from the many people living on the street, and an advocate, Ms. Friedenbeck, was talking about how after the Supreme Court in 2024 gave cities authority to enforce bans on public camping, San Francisco officials swept tent camps and moved homeless people around, I like this part, with the priority of keeping them out of sight of wealthier people. She said the jail system, with its population up about 50% since 2021, had become a revolving door for homeless people accused of misdemeanors such as illegal camping and possessing drug paraphernalia. This is definitely a tried and failed strategy, she said. I'd say we're going back about 20 years. And actually, now you know from today's speech, they were going back 200 years. And I don't know if it's in somewhere, I did find something about the huge percentage of people in prisons and jails who have mental illnesses of various kinds. And the Capital Times, May 18th, here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is facing a mental health provider shortage so severe that 1/4 of the state's counties have no practicing psychiatrists at all, and the rest don't have nearly enough to keep up with demand. Meanwhile, the cost of mental health care is falling increasingly on local taxpayers. So there's a recent report. 3 years ago, Tony Evers had charged the administration with taking on some of the state's biggest challenges facing those who live with mental illness or struggle with mental health. And there's this council assessed what they call the burgeoning mental health crisis and issued a 33-page report. We have work to do to make sure folks in crisis can get the care and support they need. We continue to see numbers that are headed in the wrong direction. Most at risk, children, parents, rural residents, veterans, incarcerated people, and those with unmet needs like food or housing. And this is where it seems to overlap with some of the other issues. Access to stable housing, primary care, quality education, childcare, community resources, nutritious food, outdoors and recreation, and healthy relationships are critical to improving mental health. When a Wisconsinite struggles to pay rent or buy food, their mental health can suffer. In turn, mental health challenges can make it difficult to meet basic needs. Oh yeah, here it is. Mental illness and mental health challenges were found to be especially prevalent in at-risk populations, such as incarcerated people, nearly half of whom have a diagnosed mental illness in Wisconsin. most counties don't have enough providers. Local governments are bearing the cost. In 2024, counties spent $903 million, a 52% increase since 2017. Now, there are proposed solutions, two key focus areas, prevention and services that support a strong foundation for mental wellness and care and treatment to ensure a coordinated response. Elements of prevention included housing and food access, child care, health care, financial stability, social connectedness. A coordinated response should include bolstering a mental health workforce, driving targeted programming and trauma-informed access to mental health care in prisons, health care facilities, community organizations, and workplaces. Additional funding needed for various services like the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, school-based services, peer counseling and recovery centers, and so on. Whether this statewide effort, so the idea would be to start implementing some specifics of the plan, which I didn't go into here, but the last sentence says, whether this statewide effort and governor's council continue under Wisconsin's next governor remains to be seen. So this is an ongoing issue, of course, nationwide and worldwide and in our community. I have no background or expertise in mental health, but I am quite sure that somebody here does. So maybe there's someone who can contribute more to the discussion. I'm sorry this wasn't a more uplifting or a happy topic. On the other hand, I guess one positive thing is that how much difference one person made. That was quite astounding. I did not realize the extent of her travels and how much difference she was able to make over a couple of decades, basically. So, do we have any comments, questions? And if we do have any people in the field, I'd be interested to hear. Oh, and one thing that I should say, those of us, when we were younger, there were these mental institutions, which sometimes had very horrific stories as well. The vision of Dorothea Dix was to build these as places that would treat people well and have all the resources. That did not always happen. And then in the 70s, was it, that those were pretty much, many of them were closed and people were put into various situations, many without support. Women were not supposed to speak in public. She spoke to legislatures and in the, when she was head of nurses, she had an official rank so that, because somebody, some officer that was in there was trying to tell her what to do, and then another man said, oh, she outranks you. So, but usually, right, and here she was traveling alone through all these places. It's quite astounding. There's probably more authoritative biographies than the ones I found that could tell us more about that. And of course, she did not write or divulge things about her personal life, but resisted writing her actual memoirs. Definitely, there are some places where schools are teaching children about emotions and about how to interact with each other, and needed even more since the pandemic. But my guess is that's probably happening in the schools that already have more resources, because at other places there have so many struggles just to get through the basic curriculum. But, and then something I read recently said, well, now that there's all the AI to do some of the other things, if the children are not going to be memorizing dates and facts, more time should be spent on emotional well-being. And this is for everybody, not for those, you know, not for just those who are diagnosed, but for all of us who could definitely use instruction on getting along with each other and dealing with emotions and dealing with life. There's also the issue that some people have mental health care tied to their work insurance, and if they were to change jobs or lose their job, they could lose that, and they don't necessarily have the money to go out and spend this privately, or not being able to even get an appointment somewhere. Yeah, I think there's a kind of this libertarian element that everybody just fending for themselves. And I think that people like you mentioned actually think the weak should die. You know, he also has an idea that diseases make you stronger, which is actually, of course, it's the opposite. There are after effects for many diseases that people don't realize. But this kind of survival of the fittest thing, if you're a weakling, you don't deserve consideration or any help. And of course, the amount of money, there's something about that. You know, how much money it costs to keep somebody in prison compared to what it would cost for the therapy or the medication or the education up front. And there's a punitive. I think that some of it is not that different from, unfortunately, from 200 years ago, that somehow this is all these folks deserve. And I was just thinking, to give us a little more hope too, I know this group often has people from local organizations speak, and maybe there's someone from the county who could talk about what resources are available, how they could use help. Are there places where people can volunteer? Are there places where you can donate or lobby, or what the really hyper-local needs are would be one way that we could get involved. So our closing words are from Dorothea Dix. They say nothing can be done here. I reply, I know no such word in the vocabulary I adopt.